kitchen, right? So this will, if we're, this will be our default room for the whole duration of the meeting, except for there will be one colloquium on Wednesday at 2 that will be in the bigger room, right? If we suddenly our meeting heats up and there will be so much participation from local people that we kind of pack this room beyond you know, its capacity, we can also switch to a bigger room, but so far it's working. We have coffee breaks and the lunches downstairs. The first coffee break today will be at, there's been an allocation of 2 hours to the intro talks, and I have half an hour, but Dima promises me to work on this because he said it has 80 slides, right? So I don't know how it's going to work, but we got to be downstairs for coffee at around 10:30, and we will resume at 11 after the coffee break. That's the idea. We don't need the whole 2 hours now, okay? But we'll see how it goes. There are also bathrooms on this floor that way and also that way, right? So good. This is my slides. A few opening slides will be on the general topic of what's interesting out there and what do we want to achieve at this meeting. And I compile them in sort of asking also opinion of Peter, Asimina, and Andre, who are together with me is a theory part of the organizing committee. We have, as I already said, very diverse skills in the room, ranging from geophysics to string theory. Because of that, I ask everyone to be very, you know, tolerant towards the backgrounds of others because we don't have the very same skills, right? And so it's very easy for us, for theorists, for example, to switch to our own jargon and get locked inside our own little theory world. But then, you know, it's always good to set us straight by asking questions and normalize everything so that everyone understands what's going on. Welcome everyone, and here in the room there are like PI regulars who come here every year, and there are some people who should come here every year, and there are some other people like Dima who came here probably 2008, and so some subset of the participants as well to the changing coupling workshop that we had with Victor Flambaum some years ago. And some of course are very new to PI, so all of you are very welcome here. So the title of the conference is of course New Ideas, which presumes that either we have new ideas or we will generate new ideas. I hope we have some ideas, right? Some of them are new, some of them are in existence or, you know, repurposed older ideas, but I really hope that out of this meeting we may come up with some additional ideas for fundamental physics applications of low energy experiments. And low energy here, understood rather broadly, we have experts in atomic molecular physics, in magnetometry, in gravitational experiments. So defined broadly is everything not LHC and not, low background dark matter scattering experiments, right? So we'll cover lots of topics here. Now, the time to throw in the new ideas is now, because right now we have the STEM model kind of emerging as a clear winner among all other possibilities. And one way, and I should say more, that the certain hopes of seeing new physics at LHC right around standard model so far not been happening. So it's maybe a time to broaden up a little bit and start exploring other adjacent topics. And I hope we'll have a productive workshop, and please remember asking questions. So I will start with something that I stumbled upon when I was, because I'm not from this field, right? When I was preparing my lectures for quantum mechanics, and I was reading through Nobel lectures by Hansch, and this plot, of course, for anyone doing some topics related to precision physics, it strikes as something really unbelievable, because usually you see curves curving that way, and it's a sensitivity or rather accuracy of measuring frequencies as a function of time, and one can see the accelerated progress there. So you get impressed, you read through this, and then you see him going into discussing fundamental applications. And one of the applications he discusses is changing couplings in time and space, which is natural. You can use this for that, of course. But one comment I want to make, that much of this has been just historic inertia, right? I mean, if you go back and ask, well, where does this topic come from? And it comes from Dicke, and then you dig deeper, it comes from Dirac. And so it's a good source. It's a good subject, but it may be also time to start rethinking it and filling it up with the new content. Also, the same goes about various successful tests of Lorentz invariance that, for example, Mike Romalis is working on. They if you dig deeper, they also sort of mostly historical, come from Hughes and maybe probably some earlier papers that I don't know of, right? So this is probably a good idea now to start rethinking this landscape and trying to think that, things that come to us from the past, the signatures, that's very nice, but can we think of something else new that can be of relevance? Now, what about this modern state of fundamental physics, right? And in case you did not hear about it, right, in 2013 was the year of the Higgs boson. So the last missing piece of the standard model responsible for the breaking of the electroweak symmetry and giving masses to gauge particles in the, like W's and Z's and the standard model fermions. It's been discovered in two experiments at LHC, and it sort of completes the picture of the standard model. It completes it in two important ways. It's three important ways. It's a missing particle. It's a origin of mass, and also so far it's been consistent with being elementary Higgs, so it points towards the existence of a new fundamental force of Yukawa type, right? Which is actually a huge deal, because the rest of the forces that we know are, gauge forces in nature. So this is a big deal in many ways, and not like, oh yes, it's another particle that's been discovered. When I was in high school in '83, we had this was a long time ago. We had a visitor from Nuclear Physics Institute visiting us and raving about the discoveries of W's and Z's at CERN. And I was thoroughly not impressed because I had a book from late 1960s by some American physicist O'Rear, and it was like the whole second half of the book was like this particle discovered, that particle discovered. Okay, so there are particles and particles, right? So the Higgs is really really a big deal, right? And it's a crowning achievement of the Stern model. Yet, if we now take this and place it into the total sort of spreadsheet of the energy balance, we encounter, well, it accounts for 5%. How come? Well, the rest comes from the mostly from the substance that carries energy, negative pressure, but doesn't cluster, that's what we call dark energy, and something which we know for sure is non-baryonic origin that is responsible for formation of structure, and that is called the dark matter. And, what to say more about it? We have lots of stuff missing in the universe. One challenge is, of course, that this pie chart comes from averaging over vast confines of empty space, right? So if we take this room now, right, the concentration of dark matter, even the most largest you can push for, is 20 orders of magnitude or so below the visible matter, and that's why it's challenging to find it. Anyways, 2013 was the year of the Higgs, and we see the Stern model emerging now. And the 2014 March and April were the months of the B word, the bicep thing that really. Sort of get us on the theory side all very excited, but now, as you may heard, things are balancing in decision, and whether this 2014 will actually come up as the year when the B mode of primordial CMB is discovered. That is a certain polarization pattern that. For which the leading candidate is the perturbations of metric consistent, of tensorial perturbations of metric, in other words, primordial gravitational waves. If this is confirmed later, this will be a very important development in our field. And we will have one talk on that subject in our conference. So what are the main challenges in dark matter, dark energy issues? How can we actually sort of make sense out of this pie chart? Well, as theorists know very well, the dark energy has, the very few good models other than cosmological constant, right? So, and even that one, poses a headache to theorists because they think, well, how come that the value is that small? Or you can ask it differently, how come that the universe is both all large and smooth, whereas it should be tiny and should not exist more than some tiny fraction of a second? That sounds ridiculous, but that's the nature of this problem. So we don't know, and there's a lot of efforts directed towards understanding the nature of the cosmological constant, and we will have one talk in cosmology oriented where Valerio will talk about this a little bit, I hope. Now the dark matter, the issues is too many possibilities, and there are many possibilities for having new particles that being born together with in the Big Bang and then being accreted sort of when the universe goes meta-dominated and started developing structure. So there is way too many possibilities for theorists to play with. And the main experimental challenge in dark matter is like we have to extrapolate from the kiloparsec scales, where the dark matter is the shortest scale, really, where it's detected, to 1 meter scale down in the laboratory, right? So shall we report it in the solar mass per parsec cube or GeV per cubic centimeter? It sounds like a rhetorical question because it's, same units, I mean, energy over volume. But in fact, it contains in itself, the extrapolation, the huge extrapolation that we have to make. Well, having said that, it's not like we are bad at extrapolating things, right? So we know very well that now in cosmology we live at the redshift z equals zero, right? Well, we can extrapolate things back in time and see how well they work, right? We can extrapolate in particular z equals zero information to z equals 10 to the 9 and go back to the time of primordial nuclear synthesis and actually predict the amount of, say, deuterium and helium-4 that exists in the universe. We can do it rather well, indeed. Or the most successful thing that happened in cosmology in the recent years is the whole deal with the anisotropies of the cosmic microwave background, which allows us to extrapolate back by size of the universe by a factor of 1,000 and have a wonderful science out of this. So this is the map taken by the Planck satellite, and you can sort of picture a god sort of taking this approach of point-like sort of painting, right? Pointillism, and so it looks very similar to French Impressionists or something. And I don't know if anyone have done the power spectrum to this one, but to this one, the power spectrum actually this is the important. Success of modern time science because we now know that this picture comes as well described by a relatively simple model, so you don't have to the statistical properties of this sky does not you don't have to postulate which dot is red and which one is blue, and even though this variation is at the level of 1 part in 10 to the 5. People have measured it. Here's the statistics of it. Here this you dominated by errors of the fact that you can partition the sky at low L only in a few patches. So there is a sample variance or cosmic variance associated with it. Further down, there is a prediction of acoustic peaks and the silk damping that. Comes from this physics of the CMB, where the primordial fluctuations in density perturbations imprint on the fluctuations of temperature, which the CMB photons that decouple from matter at around redshifts of 1,000 carry to us, and we observe that. This is different experiments match on. Without any extra fudge factors or free parameters, though, this is great. So this particular high third peak is an evidence of non-baryonic dark matter in the universe, and that's what tells us that that the abundance of dark matter is 5 times more than of the regular matter.
Maxim, why is the third peak? Why is it not the first peak
or
the second?
The first peak mostly comes from the ratio of baryons to photons. So does anyone have a better explanation? Then it's a good question. I will find a slide. You have many free parameters. You have a baryon to photon ratio that is free. There is a dark matter to the and the two variants that is free. So in the second peak, I think they when you vary them, right? In the second peak they subtract, and the third one they add, right? That's the statement I think is correct. So of course we have huge questions about dark matter physics. So we know that 80% is non-baryonic. Where does it come from? Does it have non-gravitational interactions? Because so far what's observed in the sky is not the results of atoms, you know, bumping into the dark matter and doing something. They're interacting via gravitational force, and that's it. That's the only thing that we know for sure so far, right? And can we detect the non-gravitational interactions of dark matter? That's a huge multi-hundred-million-dollar investment that the science is making now. So, and indeed, a very important question. So, what is the space of theoretical possibilities for dark matter? It's a really huge space, unfortunately. Well, fortunately, even on my sort of time, there's been a lot of theoretical evolution of thought about the dark matter. So when I started in the field, I won't tell when, but some years ago, there was basically everyone was talking about supersymmetric neutralino and an axion, and these are still good candidates. But meanwhile, we realized that there is a lot more possibilities for dark matter physics, and in the future, I predict that there will be a lot more. It switches automatically. I don't know. And in the future, it will be more interest to any models of dark matter that has some grounds to exist. So now, among the various classifications of dark matter models, there are various that include just particles that scatter off nuclei and so on, that go under the name of weakly interacting massive particles. That's mostly not going to be the topic of our meeting, but that's where most of the investments are coming in. And the another possibility that we will concentrate is, for example, the dark matter that comes from the scalar fields or pseudoscalar fields, bosonic fields in general, right, that are being displaced from the minimum of energy, being kept away from the minimum by the Hubble friction term. I'll show what it is. And then they start oscillating, providing the energy for the formation of the structure. And that's what I call super cool dark matter, because it's not in thermal contact with the Stern model, or the it's not thermalized, and the occupation numbers of this dark matter relative to photons is huge. If you try to think of placing these various possibilities on the energy chart, you will find out of various scales that we know in nature, that you find out that there is a huge energy range, say from the Hubble scale to the Planck scale and beyond, and there is like Stern model. It's a logarithmic scale, 10 minus 42, 10 to the 19 GeV. There is some energy scales that we know. Where would the dark matter mass, for example, come in, even if it's elementary particle? Well, we don't know for sure. But there is some sort of a lower bound related to the inverse size of the smallest structures that we know that dominated by dark matter. That probably is at the scale of something like 10 to minus 30 GeV. And then there is you can go all the way to the Planck scale. If it's an elementary particle, right, and if it's a more composite object of agglomeration of fields and so on, it could be even larger, right? We don't know. So, but we can put a lamppost here that is basically around the Stern model, and that's where the WIMPs will weakly interacting massive particles that everyone is looking for are sitting. So there has been a lot of investment. This is a chart from the snow mass particle physics exercise that the US community went through. So there has been hundreds of millions, I think if you sum over 30 different experiments, investment into searching for dark matter in the form of roughly 100 GeV particle, give or take, that collides with the nucleus and deposits some mass, right? So some energy at the scale of a few tens of kiloelectron volts. That's been a very successful program in the sense that the sensitivity of, after many years being pushed down by five, six orders of magnitude, and that's quite impressive, and it will continue until one hits the what's called the neutrino background, that is the scattering, the recoil from the scattering of the solar neutrinos on nuclei. So that's a big direction in science, but here we are interested also in alternative models, in particular in models where the dark matter comes from light scalar fields. And we are attracted to WIMP models by its simplicity and predictivity, but that may not be the only thing, or maybe not the thing that nature chooses. And what are the other attractive options, and specifically light scalar fields, axions, and maybe its relatives that can form dark matter are very, very attractive, and one should look for it and look for sort of maybe creating a new lamppost. And to recap on what I said, the any scalar field, but basically that's the differential the only differential equation I'm going to show. This is a double derivative in time. There is a single derivative in time, and this is the gradient of the potential over A. And this is basically like a friction term. When the expansion of the universe is fast enough, the field stays frozen to a value displaced from its minimum. When the Hubble friction term drops constantly, and as soon as it becomes smaller than, say, the mass parameter, the field starts oscillating, and that is the origin of dark matter in this models. This is an absolute triviality, what I said, for the theoretical guys here, because this is the models many, many people play with for years and years. Okay, so just looking here, one can realize that there are many interesting signatures that can occur from this. The fields we are talking about can be very light, and that can create new coherent forces between particles, masses, between spin and spin, between spin and mass. So there is that direction. Then oscillating scalar field, if it oscillates in time, it oscillates with the frequency equal to the light mass of the scalar field, say, well, I don't know, 10 minus 10 electron volt, for example. That is, that frequency can imprint itself on the interactions, due to interactions with the normal particles, on the properties of these particles, right? On the masses, on the strength of couplings, in which case you will get an oscillating pattern of the variations of, say, atomic frequency in time, right? Which is kind of an interesting signature. And also, something that I like, that non-trivial shape of this self-potential in general could lead to like stable lumps of energy for the light scalar field, because you don't expect it to be generated in exactly the same value over disconnected causal patches of the universe in the early times. In which case, you can imagine if this field interacts with this standard model, it passes through and creates a signature in time, sort of transient effect, that you may have your frequencies stable over a long period of time, but sudden there is a sudden change over a short period of time. So these are all these two the new ideas that we'd like to discuss at this meeting. So going through some possible interactions. In principle, particle physicists came up with various classifications of these interactions under the name of portals. One can write different portals, like gradient of the scalar field coupled to the spin, the coupling of the spin and mass, and so on. And if you kind of go through the various phenomena that it creates. It creates torques on spin, shift of the atomic frequencies plus extra gravitational force, and so on. And one can sort of go through the catalog and say set various constraints on this light scalar fields. And in particular, you will find out that very important constraints come from something that I haven't talked yet, and that is the astrophysics. That there are, if there are light particles much lighter than the mass of the electron, there will be new channels for draining energy from stars and so on, and that's opening up an important modification to stellar evolution if there is such full field and if it's coupled too much to regular particles. So this is also well understood by the theoretical community and, well, and by astrophysicists, and various constraints on these interactions are being derived from astrophysical sources. And we will have one talk in the meeting touching upon limits from astrophysics. So there is one elephant in the room that I should mention, and that is the issue of technical naturalness. For theorists in this room who are mostly dealing with particle physics, this is, much of our developments in the field were driven by this issue a lot. And for experimentalists, it may sound like some, construct of trying to be fancy, sort of. It's an interesting issue, right? So let's say we have a potential for a very, very light field, a scalar field, right? There are some parameters that we assume for this potential by hand, say, and we make the scalar field interact with the standard model or for some particles that are known to have like large masses, for example, right? And you calculate the, or you do something that is similar to calculating the loop corrections or quantum effects, and you will discover that all these coefficients sort of receive large corrections from quantum effects, and then you would think, okay, and I want them to be small, but the loop corrections try to make these coefficients large, right? So there is an issue then of fine tuning, right? That if you have a really light scalar field that interacts with the standard model in a non-derivative way, then there is a very good chance that you will face this issue. And that's called the technical naturalness, that it's very hard to make flat potentials out of the scalar fields. So again, this is a very plain topic for the particle theorists, although we played a lot of it, we haven't made a huge inroads into it, I should say, right? You can see that a lot of things in particle physics was driven by technical naturalness of the Higgs potential issue, and one of the sort of predictions was that we will see the new physics at LHC associated with somehow with the stability of the Higgs potential. It very well may still happen, right? But right now there is at least a fraction of the community that is scratching their heads and thinking what's happening, right? So it's an interesting issue for theorists for sure. So it's a known big issue for theories that say predict changing of couplings in time, right? Because then a smooth change in time over the lifetime of the universe, because that makes this coefficient small, and this field will have to roll very, very slowly. And if you make it interact with electromagnetic field, it's a question of how is that we're going to ensure this smooth roll. So There is a big issue here. There are some models, importantly, that escape these issues, and these are derivative interaction models. In particular, Axiom does not have that very problem. Okay, so. But I want to say that my own approach. People differ widely as to how they treat technical naturalness problems. For my own approach is that all theoretical models that have technical naturalness built in, one should really seriously think of. And the models that that are not technical and natural, you can still write papers about it if you can provide cool signatures, right? That's my approach, right? Yes.
So could you comment on what do you mean by the shift symmetry?
Oh, shift symmetry means that if you have an interaction of say this form where you have, for example. An interaction of that form. This leads to the interaction of, say, a gradient of the scalar field with a spin of this particle psi, right? This interaction is shift symmetric in the following sense, that phi is plus phi constant leaves this interaction unchanged, which means that out of the radiative corrections here, only the correction to the kinetic term of this scalar field will appear, and not the mass term. All right. So good. Now the questions that in connection with light fields we are all interested in is that have we tested long-range forces enough? Right. I mean, it's been a tremendous progress in various labs at Washington and Stanford and increasing precision of measuring gravitational forces, in particular also at the short distance scales. And have we tested them enough? And is there room for further progress? Other examples of light field models other than axions that have observable consequences, yet they're made in a technical and natural way, that's quite interesting. Other astrophysical constraints, the constraints from astrophysics on light particles, like I said, are very, very strong. Other ways of improving on existing astrophysical bounds. And these are all important, interesting questions. So going back to the topic I started with showing Hansch's lecture and so on, in the recent years, things being progressing at a rapid pace in atomic experiments, and this is probably now already a dated slide from some years ago, and constraints on changing alpha dot over alpha versus change in ME over MP coming from different atomic clocks, constraining this change to really small value. And the question that I have in relation to what I said before is that is this alpha dot constant, is that the only sort of reasonable signature to look for? And the answer is no. We should also look for various oscillating patterns of change in the coupling constant, or what I call transient phenomena, where suddenly some lump of energy comes in and renormalizes couplings during the short duration.
Okay, can I ask a question?
Yes.
If you say the variation of alpha is very strict, that's 10 to minus 15 per year, so what is the total integration time of those experiments? Because
We'll have a talk on that. So this is done on the scale of 1 year, right, or two years, right? There is also an issue of duration of the measurement, right? So if something passes through you at a rather large velocity, and say the duration of the transient effect is 10 to minus 3 seconds, then it's a question of what is the best way of seeing it, right? So these are technical issues that I'd you know, I'd like to be discussed here.
So in that specific experiment, they had 30 measurements over a year, and each measurement was integration time was for about a day or so, a few days. Yeah.
So anyways, the adding time to searches of you know, what's called what people call change of couplings in time, or change of you know, tests of Lorentz invariance, where you can think of some scalar field interacting with the spin via this gradient. The search for something that is more time concentrated, something like coming from a lump of dark matter. That's also, I think, is an interesting signature to think about. So continuing with more questions, and I'm almost done and ready to pass it to Dima, to Derek. What are perspectives for adding time into searches of changing couplings and Lorentz violation? There must be something that we can say, right? And this is very interesting to me personally. What are the best systems and strategies to look for oscillating parameters, masses, couplings, particle properties, like Peter and Surjita thinking, and Dima and the collaborators thinking about oscillating electric dipole moments. So that's a cool signature. What are the best systems and strategies to look for some transient effects and on the mass scales and couplings? Is there much gain from using networks of devices, right? Like if you can think of gravitational wave detectors, right, as things that are looking for transient signal, and clearly they benefit a lot from having different nodes, right? So this basically the idea that comes from Dima and collaborators, that one should try to do same you know, implement same idea with devices that measure spins or magnetometers, and we can, you know, definitely have being all using the devices that use correlated time, right? But maybe we can also use that for the needs of fundamental physics. And what are the backgrounds for all these searches? I don't know, but I'd like to find out. So more questions. And that some of them come from Asimina. What are the latest developments in atomic interferometry, atomic clocks, and so on, NMR, that we theorists would like to understand? What prospects for future improvements? What are the best motivated things to be looking for at energies well below LHC? That's already, I was already talking about it. Any good the dark matter candidates? Like scalar fields and so on. Now there is many $1 million question for all of us, and that is, will BICEP 2 results hold? And I can see Mark is here, so I'm hoping to get some interesting comments of what's going to happen, because like I said, March and April were like the height of the craze about the BICEP 2. Will it ever point to a very high energy scale existed during inflation? Will it disfavor things like large extra dimensions and so on, or make the story much more complicated? This is a really important question happening right now. Will it ever limit the ultralight bosonic dark matter as it seems to be limiting axions? And are there more things to learn from CMB polarization, including birefringes? So, all right.
But could you give just a very high-level explanation why, if the BICEP 2 results are correct, it would rule out some of these things you mentioned?
Yes, just a sec. So I have one slide to make, and that is we're talking about new forces of nature, and at perimeter, we have a new faculty, Nina Armanitaki, which is who is really well, not the short range, but very very strong interaction, right? So I'm expecting to have a very exciting workshop now. So I'm done, and I will answer the question by Mike. So why do we expect these things to be important from a bicep, right? So if we have so the naive interpretation of the of the bicep results. So okay, so here's the thing, right? We discover the curl mode of polarization, right? Then the chain of logic gives us that. All right, the best way of making it is from a primordial gravitational waves from inflation, right? The measured value, say 0.1, whatever, of this will point towards the scale of a Hubble scale during inflation of 10 to the 14 GeV, which points towards the root of the fourth power of inflationary energy scale at the scale of 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay? So there's like large extra dimension scenarios of the goal under the name of Argani, Hammett, Dimopoulos, and Dvalli that should explain this acronym to people here, right? that usually has you know, fundamental scales at the level of 1 TeV, right? So, and beyond that, what's that?
Or RS.
But no, you had
since
many.
You're ruling it out.
Look, Roman, I think you did not have to have a TV, right? You had other. That's because these guys had to have a TV, right? And you had the different models with. Okay, so there's a Randall syndrome. Or one or two?
One.
Okay. So anyways, that would be this scale of quantum gravity, if you like, right? And then if you have, you know, this M star much, much less than this scale suggested by Bicep, well, it means that something should be changed, right? So there may be naively you before Bicep, even still now, right? Because we don't know if it's right or wrong. Now, if you know, you could conceivably argue that inflation might have happened with an average energy density 1 TeV to the fourth, right? Bicep results, if hold, will tell you that it happens with 10 to the 16 GeV to the fourth, right? So if that's true, that means that something was really changing also a lot with this concept, say, of extra dimensions and so on, that somehow the volumes of these large extra dimensions were inflating. So your story becomes so much more complicated, and that's for sure, right? So that's why this is a big question mark right now, and.
Well, there's no question mark on the bicep measurement, right?
Well, that's right. That's basically the question about whether this measurement that nobody doubts is really attributable to the cosmic microwave background coming from early times, or it's a result of some dusty foreground, and you have to sort of wash your face or something. So that will be answered in coming months, and that's extremely exciting. All right, so I spoke for about an hour, so we might be actually on time with our schedule, because Dima and Derek have promised. How many slides?
Mark 58.
Okay.
All right.